Empower Radio presents The Farkas Files, an exploration of energy, metaphysics, and the paranormal with David Franklin Farkas. The Farkas Files. The truth is in here somewhere. Here's your host, David Franklin Farkas.
Good evening, or whatever time it is, wherever you are. Thank you one and all for being with us. We've been on a little bit of a break during the holidays because the studio is at a university and they closed for a couple of weeks. And we're back with a live recording with Dr. Mark Mirabella, and he's got a book that I'm very excited about. I've really enjoyed reading as much of it as I could before the show. So we will talk to him in just a few minutes, but first, tonight's metaphysical musing. And we didn't have a show on the solstice, but we've just gone through all of the solstice holidays, whatever tradition you happen to celebrate. All those holidays that come out around the solstice are really about the position of the sun in the sky and the length of the days. And all the stories are a little bit different, but they're all about the return of the light. And why is that? On the solstice, it's the longest night and the fewest hours of daylight at any point in the year. And then I always say that the solstice is not the beginning of winter. It's actually the beginning of spring because the days are going to get longer, there's going to be more light, and it's going to get warmer. And that's what all of the fuss about the return of light is about, is that if it doesn't happen, it's going to get colder and darker, and we're all going to die. So every tradition has a celebration that basically is, let's all get together while it's dark and light a fire and sing songs and enjoy each other's company and hope everything's going to be okay. But there's an interesting quirk to it. The sun is at the lowest point in the sky, in the southern sky, that it gets to during the year. And then it just sits there and doesn't move for 3 days. The days don't get any longer immediately. Everything just stands still. And there are several stories throughout history about the sun dying and there being a resurrection after 3 days is directly key to that astronomical event. And then the days get longer. And this year, since I have an app that lets me track it, I was looking at how much more daylight we get each day. It turns out it's about a minute. So at this point, we've gained 8 or 9 minutes more daylight, which is a wonderful thing. You know, it's no longer getting dark around here at 4 o'clock. and that's a big part of what all of this is about and connecting to nature and spirit in relationship to all of these solstice holidays. Now the days will get longer. Now life will shift in barely perceptible ways as there's more daylight. And it will not be as, well, it will be colder for a while, but it will eventually not be as cold, and life will start up again. Of course, all of you are on the other side of the planet are having the opposite. It's summer there, but we're talking about the Northern Hemisphere. And this is a time of year that always fascinates me, just always fascinates me, because it's both very subtle, most people are not paying attention to it, and also so important and has been so important in every tradition all over the world. So as we are in my country in a time of darkness and chaos, I take hope from the fact that in every cycle, when we get to that point of darkness and impending chaos, the light always returns. And imperceptibly, a little bit at a time, it returns. So here's to the return to the light and to the changes that we will get through somehow. And that's tonight's metaphysical musing. And let's have some fun and fascinating conversation with Dr. Mark Mirabello, who is a professor of history at Shawnee State University here in the U.S. and also a visiting professor at a university in Russia, which I think is fascinating. Good evening, Mark. Thanks so much for being here.
And thank you for having me on your program.
Oh, I'm excited to talk to you about the stuff that you've found and really enjoying the book. A lot of my healing work, which is remote healing, has to do with ghosts. And your book, The Traveler's Guide to the Afterlife, Traditions and Beliefs on Death, Dying, and What Lies Beyond, is absolutely fascinating to me because there are all these different stories and mythologies about death, dying, ghosts, and all of those things that I had never heard before. I'd heard a lot of them, but I had never heard most of them. And I'm really very envious that you get to go and study all this stuff.
Yes, I do. The professor's life is a great one. It's easy to do. We don't really lecture that often during the week. And I'm a bookworm, so I get to indulge my endless reading and writing.
Well, you're looking at some absolutely, to me anyway, fascinating subjects. And how did you wind up focusing on these topics as an academic discipline?
One of the advantages I have, and regrettably this is becoming really rare in the United States and major countries, I'm at a very small university. We have a 4-person history department, and we're all generalists. Now, if I were at a large institution, I'd be basically studying. I remember one professor, a leading scholar that I had in graduate school, his specialty area was congressional elections in the antebellum South in the 1850s. And he spent his life studying that. And fortunately here, I can teach a wide variety at Shawnee State University, which is 4,000. We have 4,000 students. Mm-hmm. I can teach a wide variety of discipline, or I should say subjects. And I can. I've always been a generalist. I was probably born a century too late. So this does. It gives me a free rein here. Plus, I'm senior professor here, so nobody can tell me what to do anymore. When you get tenure and you're old, you can write your own rules.
And your rules drew you into looking at traditions and mythologies and understandings about the afterlife and ghosts, which is right up my alley and a lot of the folks that listen to the show.
And by the way, one of the reasons I think maybe the book strikes for unusual for a professor to write is because, regrettably, as the discipline has gotten more professional in the late 20th, early 21st century, everybody tries to turn it into a science, and they have sort of a thesis and an argument. And I'm just dealing in information. I'm not really trying to present some comprehensive theory as where all of this comes from. I just want the reader to be able to look into the book and find all sorts of ideas from all different times, places, and traditions. And one thing I mentioned, we know of over 3,500 known societies, and as recently as 1500, the great majority were still so-called pre-literate societies, 1500 AD. So I'm drawing not just from the major civilizations and religions, and the established world religions, but traditional peoples too. And I think they come up with some really interesting notions.
Right. And that was one of the things that fascinated me, since some of my training was with indigenous people in North America. And also some of the mystery school stuff from Europe. So it was all fascinating, but you bring in cultures from all over the place, which I just found absolutely fascinating. And I found myself, sitting there going, but, and then I realized, he's just writing down all this different stuff from around the world. It's not really an argument. It's bringing together all of this information. And part of what was fascinating is how much of it conflicts with each other. Many of the ideas follow the same train of thought, and other concepts and ceremonies and other things are completely and wildly different.
Which, by the way, reminds me, one of the problems we have in Western civilizations, since it's predominantly monotheistic, it creates this notion that of the oneness of truth. And I think with your point that some of these traditions really do contradict in a striking fashion. And it seems, how can I believe anything? In fact, when I was doing a radio interview a couple weeks ago, I received an email from someone who had listened to it. And he's basically was saying, you know, that Jesus is the way and you're teaching all kinds of false information in your book. And In contrast, though, in Eastern religions, the Buddha talks about over 80,000 different paths to freedom and enlightenment. And I think Easterners tend to view, for example, any police officer would know if an accident occurs or a crime, you have to take information from every possible witness because no witness is going to have an accurate description. And then you put them all together and you try to sort of cherry pick what is the best for you, at least. I shouldn't say with a police officer. But what I'm doing is this idea is that there's all these various traditions and there's different paths for different types of people. Also reminds me, in Hinduism, they have various paths of yoga for the emotional person, for the logical Mr. Spock type, for the person who is very active personality, and so forth. And I think in the West, we need more of that. Just this idea, again, I'm not in any way denigrating the traditional Judaic-Christian tradition. It's a valid tradition. It helps a lot of people find inner peace and perhaps salvation. But there's more to it. There's all kinds of a wide variety of opinions as to what happens. At times, by the way, I was it reminds me, in the West, very few people are doing this near-death experience research. Dr. Raymond Moody, some years ago, really pioneered it with a wonderful book, Life After Life. Mm-hmm. And we now have a few researchers studying what happens to people that are clinically dead and then come back. And, of course, they're describing beings of light and wonderful things. But anyone who's read the Tibetan Book of the Dead would realize these people aren't in heaven, strangely enough, according to Tibetans, at least. They're witnessing the threshold on the other side, and then the descent occurs, a descent, I should say. And after seeing the clear light of the void, which is brighter than a thousand suns and louder than a thousand lightning strikes, you'll see wonderful beckoning beings, which the Tibetans say will be based on the content of your mind. So someone will see Jesus, someone will see Archangel Gabriel, someone will see Shiva, so on and so forth. But the Tibetans say don't be drawn towards that because it's going to cause you to go off the correct path. And then after about several days pass, you then start to encounter terrible beings, which a Westerner may think he's in hell. But the Tibetans say, no, you're not. This is from the content of your mind. And throughout this journey of roughly 49 days, you have to remain calm and dispassionate, and it takes you to a better, more positive either rebirth or perhaps even liberation.
It's all of that fits with the things that I have seen psychically in doing the work that I did. And one of the concepts that I later read other people saying is that there isn't one hell. There are as many hells as there are beliefs that you have sinned and ways that you think you're going to be punished. And that basically all of the people who have the same belief that believe they're being punished wind up in the same place, all having the same experience, but only being held there by their belief. And I have a wonderful friend who's been on the show many times, Christina Rake, who's a theologian and also is a psychic, which makes it a whole lot of fun. And she's read a lot of the ancient texts in the original languages. So she's my go-to person anytime I want to say, so how does it come out? Judeo-Christian stuff? I mean, do you see it the same way? She said, yeah, I've seen that over and over again. And in the Aramaic, and then she quoted a scripture that I had not heard before, and explained to me what the actual meaning of it was. And basically it was, you will be punished in the way that you believe that you will be punished, which may be what judge not that you be not judged really means. So all of these different layers, all of these different things from all over the world somehow really seem to be talking about the same thing, just with wildly different ways of saying it and talking about it.
By the way, one point I mention in the book, and again, I do this without comment. I'm not trying to say it's correct or incorrect, but it does seem that the, because again, in the West, we tend to have certain assumptions about the afterlife, that we always involve an ethical dimension and say that there's reward and punishment.
Right.
But curiously enough, that only appears with the civilizations. Now again, we've probably spent at least 99.9% of human existence on the planet has probably been in the hunting and gathering stage. And then with the civilizations which come with sort of horticulture and agriculture, suddenly this ethical component appears. And apparently the earliest ones to come up with this would be the ancient Egyptians, we think. Again, this is all theoretical because Easterners would say the early Hindus and so forth. It does seem to be it sometimes for social control purposes to tell the people, well, if you're not, you see evil people prosper, or I guess if you're a Clinton supporter, get elected president. And why is this happening on this planet? And they say, well, don't worry, this will all be fixed over on the other side. And some of the points I discuss in the book would be basically these notions that it's completely detached from ethics. And in fact, oddly enough, in some cultures, what we would consider heinous criminal acts are taking people to higher levels. I'm not trying to recommend anyone go out and commit crimes, but there's so many different notions of what is positive behavior. And I think, again, a problem with the ethical side is we forget everyone in the West tends to be like Socrates and Immanuel Kant and say that morals are absolute, that what is good is always good in any time and any place. But again, a Christian moral system doesn't really work if you're living, you mentioned interest in Aboriginal peoples, indigenous populations. If you're a Comanche on the high plains, in the South Plains in the 19th century, turning the other cheek and being a person of peace is not going to work. And as a result, the Comanche religion and moral system actually encouraged violence in men, both to slay the megafauna, the bison, and also to kill and even torture other men. And now in our culture, torture, we have this issue now with governments torturing again, but we find it a heinous act. But the Native Americans, they viewed it, if you were a Comanche brave and you were captured, that person would view the torturing process as an opportunity to show his manhood and courage.
Right.
And would demand it. Now, again, I can't imagine demanding to be tortured, but this is the kind of men that were produced, very courageous, tough individuals, and in that context. And we may have at some future date some horrible global extinction event. We have all kinds of sci-fi novels and movies about this where everything is destroyed. Right. And oddly enough, the people best fitted to survive in that context would be the individuals now serving in the maximum security prisons, strangely enough. Because all the pencil neck professors will be dead in the first 2 weeks.
Right, because they're violent rule breakers.
Yeah. Yes.
That whole aspect, and I found that whole, because you quote a number of different cultures where the afterlife either had nothing to do with ethics or had to do with some display of manhood and violence, reminded me of the Klingons in the Star Trek mythology. That in order to die with honor and go across the river of blood to Stovokor, is their way of saying it, you had to die in battle.
Yes, that's
you had to die as a...
We find that in many traditions, the Spartans, the early medieval Vikings, the pre-Christian Vikings, the samurai Japanese warriors, the Aztecs. It's not as... rare as I think a lot of modern people would think. And it's, again, it's the cultural demands at the time made that they endorsed that. I think when it comes to ethics, I think the ancient Greeks, who were really clever at many things, I think they perhaps, this is my opinion now, I wouldn't say this in the book, but had it right, because there were no commandments for Mount Olympus. The Greeks thought that ethics were things people work out for themselves so they can live together. So they will vary from time to time and society to society. And I think we often forget that. Modern America, especially recently, tries to export its values. And we forget that this is not a universal value system that may not work everywhere. And we are intolerant. For example, our values will often clash with African values. And we're outraged by this. And we act as if, why can't you run your countries the way you run ours? Because these are different cultural traditions. In fact, Africa has some interesting, while we're talking warlike types, obviously the traditional Zulu in South Africa and the Maasai in East Africa, these are pretty tough cultures. And notice they're always seem to be animal pastoralists, in this case, herding the large animals, cattle. Shepherds tend to be, the shepherds are kind of like the weaker guys. But the cowboys, even in our culture, are the tough guys.
Right, right. Big animals and protecting them from predators, of both animal and human predators, is a recurring theme all over the world. And that whole, you start taking it into wartime and you get the flyboys and the other people who do outrageous, brave things are the ones that all the stories are told about in much the same way. Of course, acting the same way when there's no war and you're just trying to get along in a neighborhood somewhere doesn't work quite as well. And that's the problem with gang wars and all the other stuff. But all of that's about money.
I think our
exporting our supposedly moral values also is probably mostly about money.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, the Aztecs, their gods so demanded blood. Now, again, this wasn't because they were barbarous. It's because they thought the gods had shed their own blood to make the current world, and they needed blood to keep it going. They had the flower wars, and these are wars were designed just to capture people. They could be sacrificed. So when you mentioned that there's no need for war, we should be killing anymore, we have some cultures where there's this constant need for violence.
Right.
Now, again, I'm not trying to say the whole book is about that kind of thing, obviously, but it is interesting. And we do have, for example, Jainism is by far, this influenced Mahatma Gandhi. They're by far the most placid and peaceful, all kinds of violence at any level, including violent thoughts and violent words, take you down in the karmic rebirth process. And the extreme Jains even avoid picking an apple off the tree because it hurts the tree. So they pick it off the ground and eat it. Also, some really devoted Jains only eat the leftover food that other people leave behind. And they restrict themselves to 32 mouthfuls of food each meal. And this is all an attempt to avoid violence.
Yeah. Right. We are going to go to a break shortly. I want to make sure people know where to find you. What's your website?
It's my name, markmirabello.com, MarkMirabB as in boy, ELLO.com. And I would have all the information. And again, contact information, reference to my profession and so forth at Shawnee State University. So just
And the list of fascinating books, because the range of topics I thought was absolutely great fun. I want to hear more about some of the wide range of diversity that you found in studying all the different extremes of belief. It's just fascinating, absolutely fascinating. So we're going to be back shortly, unless, of course, we get taller. My guest tonight is Dr. Mark Mirabella. And we will continue this fascinating conversation about basically beliefs about the afterlife all over the world. And obviously a topic that I love and I know a lot of you listening love. So don't go nowhere. We'll be right back.
Listening to Empower Radio, an entire radio station devoted to your personal development, expanding your conscious awareness, and empowering positive change. Meet our hosts and listen online at EmpowerRadio.com, on iHeartRadio, TuneIn, Stitcher Radio, or iTunes, or download the Empower Radio app for your smartphone or tablet. It's free in the App Store, and it lets you listen to our shows and podcasts on demand. Empowering people, empowering change. Empower Radio, online at EmpowerRadio.com.
When Dad needed help getting around, I became his driver. Any daughter would do the same. But soon enough, he needed help doing more things, and it was up to me to be his personal shopper and financial manager, too. And before I knew it, Dad moved in with me. So I became his cook, his personal assistant, his physical therapist, and even his nurse. When I started taking care of Dad, I didn't realize all the roles I'd have to play. But no matter what, I know I'm still his daughter.
We understand the many roles you play. And to help, we created an online caregiving resource center. At aarp.org/caregiving, you can find resources and connect with the caregiving community. Together, we can better care for ourselves and the ones we love. Visit aarp.org/caregiving to learn more. A public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
I want to thank my mommy for loving me so much, for taking me out to the park, for reading me books, for taking
me to the doctor when I broke my foot in ballet rehearsal,
for leaving me alone when I wanted to be alone.
And now, as a grown-up, I'm thankful for being able to take care of you, my dear mom, for having the chance to take you to the park, for reading you those books we enjoy so much, for being able to take you to your therapies after you twisted your ankle, for understanding that sometimes you simply want to be alone.
Roles change without us noticing. And in your new role, we help you help. Visit aarp.org/caregiving to get practical health and wellness tips to provide even better care for your loved one. Remember, visit aarp.org/caregiving. AARP, we help you help. A public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
This is a guided meditation on parenting. Take a deep breath in and let go of the time you and your son played basketball and you attempted to slam dunk. Or when you hit that piñata into your neighbor's yard. Let it go.
You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. There are thousands of teens in foster care who don't need perfection. They need you. For more information on how you can adopt, visit AdoptUSKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUSKids, and the Ad Council.
Empower your life. Empower Radio.
Now back to the Farkas Files with David Franklin Farkas on Empower Radio.
And we're back with Dr. Mark Mirabella, and we're talking about his incredible book about the afterlife. So that it's kind of fun for me to hear the range of extremes of the beliefs. And I found it fascinating that historically it's the agrarian cultures that weave ethics into the afterlife. That's an interesting turning point.
And by the way, another thing that I think would probably surprise most Westerners, again, we tend to bind all this to the concept of a God. And now, again, I'm not trying to say there is not a God, But there are traditions, well, that God is completely unnecessary for the afterlife. It runs on its own. For example, in Theravada Buddhism, and one of the really fascinating groups would be, I talk about them in the Central Aboriginal Australians, Central Australia Aboriginal people. And they, first of all, their idea of the afterlife, the dead people never even leave the planet. We find this in Melanesian cultures. They always stay, they go towards the west, towards the setting sun. And when a person dies, according to the Central Australians, and incidentally, I want to remind you, the listeners, if they're not aware of this, the British, when they encountered the Aboriginal people in the late 18th century, much as Americans do today, they tended to judge on technological level and development level in terms of physical things. And they saw these naked people that really hadn't even developed the bow and arrow. Of course, they had the return boomerang. They had never boiled water. They had no idea, were fascinated when they saw it, because they didn't have pottery. And the British dismissed them virtually as animals, in fact, sadly. And in the early 19th century in Tasmania, they were actually having hunting expeditions. Even the ministers would participate, go out and kill these men and women. But at any rate, the Aboriginal people of Central Australia, they don't have a god. And they think that the soul, which they believe we have one, is about the size of a grain of sand. And when a person dies, it travels west. And then it lurks in the sacred sites of the tribal band, which typically would be a waterfall or some kind of mountainous or cliff area, something spectacular. And then when the proper woman comes along, the soul decides to enter through her navel and be born again. And incidentally, this is probably would surprise a lot, again, listeners. They had no idea, and I'm not denigrating the people. This is actually a discovery of the farmers. Like many hunters and gatherers, the Aboriginal people had no idea that sex causes birth because of the nine-month separation. And they were promiscuous people, having sex all the time at even young ages. So they never made the connection. And we find a lot of cultures that were that way at the hunting and gathering stage. And it's the farmer who makes that discovery. By the way, probably the first one was a woman, probably the early farmers. And they noticed that when you make a hole in the earth, and of course the earth represents the womb, and you place a seed in the earth, it grows. And from that became the notion that actually sex causes birth. But these Aboriginal people had really no god. And the whole thing ran automatically, so to speak.
Well, my sense of what little I know about that culture from some other folks I've talked to is that it's like a lot of other indigenous cultures in that all of nature is considered to be alive and spiritual, and it's a communication directly with everything. So they don't need to create a separate personality that we call God and give it other powers. It's more of a communication with every single thing that exists. They are a part of it, and it is a part of them, and they don't see the need for that personality.
That is a good point. That's exactly how it is. And again, the omnipotent God seems to be a development, once again, of high civilizations, because of the reason if there's a king, for example, the ancient Persians had literally the fellow's title was the King of Kings, and he would give an order to his satraps, and then all over the empire, everyone would obey, and when people entered into his presence, they would kneel and bow. And that's where the modern notion, which you see not only in Christianity, but especially in Islam, that we have this all-powerful entity that we must bow to, and because of his power, that's where it comes from, we think. Now, again, I'm not trying to denigrate these traditions, but the notion that with humans tend to interpret the unknown in terms of the known. And I have a feeling you're well-read in various modern developments, that it's kind of curious to me that, and I've researched this as well, we're getting the proliferation of now neo-pagan religions once again in the late 20th and 21st century. It's because in our democratic system, the all-powerful tyrant is no longer an admirable figure. And we tend to see decentralization and rule by committee, if you will, as somehow superior to rule by the one. So So this could be explained why these neo-pagan groups are making a comeback.
Right, and that's kind of, you know, I hate to say it's a hippie thing, but it came out of the 60s and a movement towards things being more democratic and less structured and rebellion against all authority. And one of the things about at least the way some of the pagan religions are being practiced now as egalitarian group activities is very much like what started in the 60s.
Exactly.
Although without having that spiritual focus to it. And I think a lot of the political movements as well have moved the left political movements are very similar. You know, mostly group process and coming together to come to a decision rather than having leadership attempting at having non-hierarchical structures, although my opinion is you have to have people responsible for that.
By the way, which is curious, I think, because most Americans and Westerners, I don't think, would realize this. Of course, the historians would. We tend to think, for example, you mentioned egalitarianism. We also have the notion of, in modern era, greater tolerance for different non-traditional sexual practices, and glorification of women and also more gender equality. People don't realize that, in fact, these characterize primitive. Now, I don't mean primitive as backward, but early societies, pre-civilization. Right. The women and the men are more equal. They're more egalitarian. There's no hierarchy. That if there is a chief, he just makes suggestions. He doesn't control things. Oddly enough, these earlier societies in small bands, they practice abortion commonly. That was viewed as a really revolutionary thing when it was brought back in the 1970s United States. The great civilizations tend to practice infanticide and think abortion is a heinous crime. They would, like the Romans and the Greeks, wouldn't kill a child till they could look at it. And if the child was healthy, strong, they'd let it live. Spartans and Romans would kill it if it were disabled, weak, puny, sickly.
Right.
But in traditional cultures, they typically use various herbs and, I don't recommend this to anybody, but various types of physical manipulation to abort babies. And everything we're glorifying now as modern is actually a throwback. So again, shows that history tends to be circular.
Right. And a lot of the indigenous cultures, especially in North America, were matriarchies.
Yes.
And it was the women that owned the property. It was the women who were the leaders and the decision makers.
Although I should mention, I noticed some modern historians have taken that a bit far. Women were clearly consulted and so forth. But we've never really found a pure, if you think of the Rider Haggard novel of She, that was the 19th century adventure novel with the leader She Who Must Be Obeyed. And the notion that, although there may have been such societies. In the 1960s, a Eastern European historian gained fame talking about was originally a placid agricultural societies in Southeast Europe, in the Balkans in particular, and that warlike Indo-European patriarchal cultures invaded and destroyed them. We're not really clear on this, but I have a feeling there probably were some strong female societies we just lost track of.
Right.
And by the way, there's a curious myth. It's found both in Australia and in the extreme south of South America among the Patagonian indigenous people. And in both cases, boys in the prepubescent period have very little contact with the men, and they're raised by the women. And they're told, the women tell them that men have some kind of special power. They'll discover it when they reach puberty. And then in both cases, there's a puberty ritual. In the case of Australia, it's actually quite harsh. Right. The boys go through a really severe form of circumcision at puberty. In fact, in one form, it's actually the genital shaft is actually split. And they put bark and so forth to keep it from ever healing properly. Now, clearly, that's an attempt to imitate a vagina on the boy. And they have to go this through the ceremony. Now, again, this is no longer being done. It was done in the 19th century. They go through the ceremony to show their courage. And then during the ceremony, the old men tell the pubescent boys the secret of male power. And then the same myth is found in South America, Patagonian Indians, that the women once ruled through magic, but we trick them. And we don't have any power. We just use trickery to gain control. And the same story is found on the other side of the planet.
Right.
Kind of interesting. Right.
Well, and things, there are parallels all over the place. I'm always amused watching some of the Catholic rituals, knowing Hindu rituals, having practiced yoga for quite a while. And they're exactly the same.
Well, in fact, when the Europeans were reached Tibet in the 19th century, they found in some of the Dymal Vehicle Buddhism these really elaborate rituals that resembled Roman Catholic masses and sacraments. And, of course, the Spanish found similar rituals. There was a sacrament of penance, if you will, among the Inca in Peru, where people would confess their sins. And they, of course, thought it was the devil who was mocking the true faith. But humans tend to come up with the same, often, solutions to problems. And, for example, often we need a purgation ritual to set us back with society. And that's probably why the idea of confession is found. And also, we tend to be really ritualistic. You were talking about how Catholics are surprised by the similarities with Hinduism. I've often noticed that some of these modern neo-pagan revivals, they tend to imitate the Christians with their ceremonies. And they have no idea they're doing this. They're just simply in a Christian culture. For example, the notion of a weekly service is clearly a Christian concept. Pagans didn't, the Romans and the Greeks and the Vikings didn't have weekly times to go to the temple. They would have holidays and festivals and so forth. But the modern people are thinking in Christian terms, and therefore it manifests even in the pagan revivals.
Yeah, it's all really fascinating how without realizing it, without having the information in any direct lineage, things have shown up all over the world and are showing up again now. So it's really fascinating. But we're here to talk about ghosts, and we still have a few minutes. What was the most interesting concept of ghosts that you ran across? Well, first of all, do you have any personal experiences of ghosts at all?
Well,
has just been basically academic.
Well, I'll preface that by saying, in terms of experience, again, I think most listeners would realize, because in the West we tend to run all the, I keep disparaging the West, we tend to run a lot of stuff together. And the people that are listening, the most likely chance of having a meaningful contact with the dead will be with a wraith, it's called, traditionally, and the Scots call it that. And that will occur usually around 24 hours of the death. And often it's a message is being conveyed. The living person is told about the location of a will. A living person is told who committed the crime that killed the dead person. The living person is told, I still love you. Don't be concerned that I've passed. Now, in contrast, the haunting, which is what most people think of as ghosts, they tend to do the same thing over and over again. For example, the person will see a woman in white walking along the side of the road, or in an old castle, or a headless man. And 19th century scientists, sadly, were more sophisticated, I think, than some of the modern scientists. They tried to seriously research all this. Although one of the reasons they tended to come up with, I should say, perhaps a disappointing conclusion, is they noticed that most apparitional contact is meaningless. It's the same thing. And if you try to communicate, nothing really happens. And therefore, they came up with various theories. One was Myers, who was a 19th century, what we would now call a parapsychologist. He suggested that when we're seeing ghosts, we're actually experiencing the telepathic dreams of the dead. They're dreaming, and we're picking up their thoughts. Now, I think a lot of the confusion about hauntings would be cleared up, once again, if we study world cultures, because they typically do not view the ghost as the entire person. Most traditional cultures have multiple souls, and American Indians had this, was very common. And what you're actually witnessing is a grave ghost, and it stays behind, much as we, there's a mind soul that goes elsewhere, and that's what we would consider the afterlife soul. And then just as we leave a corpse behind when we die, we also leave a kind of astral corpse behind. And that's what you're seeing in most cases. That's why, and there's no meaningful communication going on. However, there's a whole other layer here, and you can and Jewish rabbis talk about this notion. There are some people, and we're talking about the mind now, the mind soul, that they linger. They don't realize they're dead, and they stay here. And they may stay in a house. They may stay in a location. As I did my
research, as my work moved more towards things involving ghosts, the number that comes up all over the world is 80 to 90% of ghosts don't know they're dead, which I found mind-boggling.
Yes. In fact, in Jewish tradition, you're supposed to, if you can somehow convince them they're dead, the ghost leaves once he realizes that he is. And by the way, in our tradition, I've always found it curious when people fear ghosts because it would be proof of some level of existence after death.
Right, exactly.
Should be good news. And this notion that my house is haunted, I'm afraid. If anybody's unfortunate, it's the ghost. That's the equivalent of we feel compassion for homeless people in our society. That's what a ghost is. If he, again, is this entity that has stayed behind, has not moved on, he is, and incidentally, in the traditions, another thing Westerners tend to do in modern world, not the ancients, you'll get people playing with Ouija boards and trying to ask questions, especially of the future and present. The Greeks argued that the characteristic of a living person is our minds, emotions, and so forth change daily. But a ghost is frozen in time at the time of his death. So if you communicate with a ghost from 1952, he's going to think it's 1952. He's not going to know anything about the future. Or even, frankly, 1962. And he will be, just imagine someone who dies today, all of his ideas, prejudices, fears, hopes are frozen. And the ghost is thinking that it's still, he's living in the house, nothing has changed. And incidentally, the old traditions of ghost walking through walls, it's based on ideas that he still will be living in the geography of his time. So if you are in an old house and you divide a room and put a wall in between a large room, he's going to act as if the wall is not there, if it didn't exist in his time. So that's why you'll see him walking to the wall.
Right.
But he will walk around furniture that existed in his time.
Right. Although one of the classic things I see frequently is the woman of the house, you know, granny, who is always in the kitchen. If you change that kitchen, they get really annoyed with you. They don't know what's going. They don't know what's going on, but they know it's changing, and they just want it to stop.
And it would be how we would be disturbed if someone disrupted our home,
right?
Today while living.
Right.
So, and by the way, if one of the traditions I mentioned is that in the work, if someone feels somehow plagued by the haunting, almost always there's going to be a body there. The famous incident with the Fox sisters who start the modern spiritualist movement in 1848, and that's what the knocking sounds they heard, and you know, one was yes, two was no. And the entity communicated he'd been a murder victim. And then, oddly enough, later, in the 20th century, they actually found a skeleton in the cellar of that particular house in Hydesville, New York, which, strange enough, was not far from where Joseph Smith found the golden plates, which also happened roughly the same time, starting the Latter-day Saints. There was all this activity. By the way, if you look at a lot of websites on the Fox Sisters, because, again, listeners may go check that out, and this is what I find disappointing about modern research often, they'll mention the hostile sites will mention that one of the Fox Sisters later admitted it was all a hoax. Now, this, again, is what started modern...
How would she know?
Sorry?
One of the things is, how would she know?
Well, what I was going to say is, what they don't mention is she was an old lady who had an alcohol problem by that time and was penniless, and they paid her a large sum of money to go on a stage and say she made it up. But they'll point to that. In fact, oddly enough, Houdini, we know in a couple of cases, was actually distorting information to discredit mediums. He went on a campaign to discredit communication with the dead. He himself was very close to his mother and tried to communicate, and then this given story is he was thought they were all frauds and went on, and then he discredited them. We found a few examples, modern researchers, where he was actually altering the evidence to accuse them of being charlatans. There was one woman who was the wife of a prominent Boston physician. She had no interest in fame or money for these matters, and she agreed to be scientifically tested. Strangely enough, he was put on the committee, and we now know he was actually altering the information. And, of course, Houdini also has the famous story that it works both ways when you try to argue fraud. He did have a message that he was going to try to convey to his wife if he predeceased her. And within a year, a New York spiritualist claimed he got the message and went to the widow of Houdini and said, this is what it was. And she went to the press and said, yes, indeed, he got it right. But a kind of unscrupulous journalist then tried to discredit the spiritualist minister and said he and Houdini had concocted this. Now, Houdini's death was totally unexpected. Famous story.
I hate to interrupt you because the stories are so wonderful, but as always happens with fascinating guests, we're running out of time.
Okay, sorry.
And I hope you'll come back at some point, especially if you have some other book that you would like to talk about.
Well, you're an interesting host, and I want to thank you for having me on. Mm-hmm. And you're clearly a well-read person with a lot of interest in these subjects, so it was a fascinating experience for me.
Well, good. Certainly was a lot of fun for me, and the book is wonderful. This is Dr. Mark Mirabello, and his book is A Traveler's Guide to the Afterlife, Traditions and Beliefs on Death, Dying, and What Lives Beyond. And I read most of it, and it's just fascinating, just a wonderful book. So thank you so much for that. If you'd like to hang out for a couple of minutes after the show, we can chat if you have a few minutes. And again, my guest is Dr. Mark Mirabello, and his website is markmirabello.com. So if you have gotten curious about who is this guy David and what in the world is he doing, you can go to househealing.com, and cleverly hiding in plain view is every conceivable way of getting in touch with me, including a link to schedule a 20-minute free phone consultation about a person, place, situation, business, whatever it happens to be, and we'll see if my work might be helpful to you. If you want more information about the show, that's at thefarkasfiles.com. The whole archive, we've been doing this now for almost 6 years, so there are hundreds and hundreds of wonderful interviews with amazing people. Easiest way to access that is with the Empower Radio app at this point. Which lets you get it all, see the entire archive for every one of the shows. There's wonderful content 24/7 with all kinds of uplifting messages. So please check out Empower Radio. And we're also on every streaming media outlet iHeartRadio, TuneIn, Stitcher, all of those. And you can find us everywhere. And I hope you will enjoy it. I'm always fascinated hearing where people are listening and when they fit it into their lives. I get all kinds of interesting little tidbits from people. And it's very exciting because why would we do this if you weren't listening and getting something out of it? So thanks for sharing some time with us once again. And it's wonderful to be back after the holidays and recording live again. So until next week, this is David Franklin Farkas for the Farkas Files. The truth is in here somewhere on Empower Radio. And have a fantastic week. Enjoy every minute of additional daylight that we're getting.